many young men who are looking for work who are also very much at risk of being exploited in those kinds of work environments where they're underpaid, they're forced to endure long hours of work.
Myanmar's Rohingya now at risk for trafficking in Bangladesh. It's Friday, August 3rd, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Doug Bernardi in Washington. Also this half hour, China tells the U.S. to cool it with talk of trade war, saving the Pakistani white vulture and cleaning the oceans of miles of plastic. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Singapore Thursday hosted senior officials from Southeast Asia for an annual meeting overshadowed by trade tensions between the U.S. and China. The ASEAN ministers also appeared to have made progress on a 15-year effort to devise a code of conduct in the disputed South China Sea that aimed at resolving maritime disagreements diplomatically. Friday, ASEAN members will join other countries, including the United States, for a larger regional security forum. University of New South Wales Professor Emeritus Carl Thayer spoke with VOA's Victor Beattie about what he sees as progress on forging a draft single document on a code of conduct to ease tensions in the South China Sea.
They have a mutually agreed time frame to complete this, and they've stated they will hold three hearings on this draft to reduce it and to get it into a manageable text. So, in one sense, it's light at the end of the tunnel. I've seen the document, 19 pages, and it's cut in pace, and many options are listed. Why it's important, it won't change the status quo, it won't change China's construction on its artificial islands, but it will bring in confidence-building measures, it will bring in cooperative programs, and it will provide for dispute settlement mechanisms on a voluntary basis so China can opt out yet again. But it lists a whole series of international law and behaviors that should restrict or constrain China to a certain extent.
Now, after the ASEAN meeting comes the ASEAN Regional Forum, in which more countries, of course, including the U.S., are involved. North Korea seems to loom large. There's a concern by the U.S. that other countries are not keeping the lid on sanctions with regard to North Korea.
At the last meeting, they adopted a statement on Korea, which is boilerplate, and we're likely to hear it again, as they express grave concern on these developments. They will urge North Korea to comply with U.N. sanctions, and they will call for the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and applaud the North-South talks. Secretary Pompeo can attend this meeting and raise his concerns and point fingers or name and shame, if he wants to, countries that are violating the U.N. sanctions. But the ASEAN members, they are the chair, will respect the U.N. sanctions because they always have gone the U.N. charter route as their national legal protection. But it has no force, except moral force, political force, on particular countries.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's presence underscores American engagement in what is now being called the Indo-Pacific region. How important is that?
As Secretary Pompeo made clear, and what I've been telling people for years, that the United States has the largest cumulative investment in that region of anybody, and that's not going to go home. And it's also the largest two-way trading partner of most countries in the region. As a global power, it has a vital interest in seeing the sea lines of communication through the South China Sea, linking the Pacific and the Indian Ocean, are kept open.
Against the backdrop of this meeting are rising trade tensions between the U.S. and China, even threatening to drag Southeast Asia into these tensions. Will he get a message about that when he's there?
Well, he'll get a message that they would like these disputes to be solved. Any slowing of China's growth will impact the region because many countries produce the widgets and gadgets that go to China that are assembled and then exported. That's their linkage. A slowing of the growing economy is going to hurt general demand for goods from Southeast Asia, and therefore there is a concern that way. And two, ASEAN wants to maintain its centrality, but it can't do that in the U.S.-ASEAN trade area disagreement. But it can, through some of its powerful dialogue partners, Japan and Australia, try to put diplomatic counterpressure back on China and the United States, in a sense, to get on with and resolve that particular problem.
University of New South Wales Professor Emeritus Carl Thayer, he spoke with VOA's Victor Beattie. These are among the top Asia stories currently trending on voanews.com. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is in Malaysia, the first stop of an Asian tour expected to focus on promoting free trade. The United States has frozen the assets of three Pakistanis linked to Lashkar-e-Taiba. Chinese actress Fan Bingbing has disappeared from social media amid rumors that she is the target of a tax evasion investigation. And the Taliban announced it has cleared Afghanistan's northern Jowzan province of the Islamic State group. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. The International Organization for Migration reports that thousands of Rohingya Muslims in Bangladesh are at risk of falling prey to human traffickers who exploit them sexually and for forced labor. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
Around 1 million Rohingya live in cramped, squalid camps in Cox's Bazar. More than 700,000 have fled since August, escaping violence and persecution in Myanmar. In their haste to leave, most have arrived in Bangladesh with nothing more than the clothes on their backs. The International Organization for Migration says their destitution and lack of job opportunities make them extremely vulnerable to human traffickers. It says women and girls are at particular risk of being trafficked into the sex trade and of being violently abused. IOM spokesman Paul Dillon tells VOA women and girls as young as 11 are vulnerable to being trafficked as domestics in slave-like conditions.
There is a burgeoning cottage industry and manufacturing where, you know, you have many young men who are looking for work who are also very much at risk of being exploited in those kinds of work environments where they're underpaid, they're forced to endure long hours of work. In some cases, they're not allowed to return home with any regularity.
Because of the clandestine nature of the crime, IOM has identified only 78 victims of trafficking in the past 10 months. But the UN Migration Agency notes this represents just a fraction of the true number. It says it has a lot of anecdotal evidence that thousands are at risk from all forms of trafficking. IOM is the lead agency coordinating the fight against human trafficking in Cox's Bazar. Dillon says the agency is scaling up its counter-trafficking activities. These include protection, prevention, psychological and material aid to survivors, and legal assistance to victims. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Happening now in Asia, third quarter results from Apple show that 31% of revenues came from the Asian region. China was especially strong. Asia's growing population provides a strong basis for growth, not just based on new products or increased market share. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia today. The population of the white-backed vulture, which inhabits Africa and parts of Southeast Asia, has declined significantly over the past several decades, to the point that it is now considered by conservationists an endangered species. In Pakistan, conservationists believe a contributing factor in the bird's decline is the use of a certain drug on livestock, whose carcasses are a major source of food for the scavenger. But a decade-long conservation effort appears to have halted the alarming decline in the population of the critically endangered species of vulture in Pakistan. Ayaz Ghul has more from Islamabad.
This breeding center in the Changa Manga forest was set up in 2005 by the World Wildlife Fund in coordination with Punjab provincial authorities. The aim was to increase the population of rapidly vanishing white-backed vultures.
White-backed vultures is critically endangered, and we have kept this white-backed vulture in this facility at the back. Currently, we have 21 species of white-backed in this facility.
But it was only in 2016 that the center succeeded in breeding the vulture stock. Since then, it has successfully hatched 6 chicks. All of them are healthy and have fledged, say WWF officials. Organizers discovered during the breeding effort that the white-backed vulture is a shy bird and does not like to be fed by different people.
These birds are very sensitive to any form of human interference around their aviary and tend to avoid eating when they're served food. Staffers who are assigned to feed them wear special white-colored veils so they all look alike. We feed them twice a day. Usually their food includes donkey meat.
Pakistanis generally despise vultures. Few seem aware that without these scavenger birds, the carcasses of livestock would rot and spread disease, posing serious health and environmental problems.
They eat dead animals and they clean the environment. So they are basically natural safeguards of the environment.
Researchers say the use of the pain-killing drug diclofenac sodium on livestock is to blame for vultures' population decline. They note the birds die after eating animal carcasses contaminated with the drug. The World Wildlife Fund persuaded Pakistani authorities to ban the medication in 2006. But officials at the center complain the drug continues to be used illegally, a factor likely to discourage plans to ultimately release the birds to the wild. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
VOA's Learning English is available online at learningenglish.voanews.com. Check out our programs such as Let's Learn English, English in a Minute, Everyday Grammar, and many more. VOA's Learning English, your reliable source for learning English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Asia-Pacific equities fell on Thursday after Donald Trump ratcheted up trade pressure on Beijing. Hong Kong's Hang Seng was among the worst performers, falling by 1.1%. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. And VOA Asia continues. From water bottles to straws to disposable utensils, plastic is everywhere, and it's creating an environmental nightmare. On this week's edition of Plugged In, VOA contributor Greta Van Susteren sits down with a U.S. lawmaker and leaders from the plastics industry and conservation sectors to look at how countries and communities around the world are addressing this global problem. VOA's Elizabeth Chernoff has more.
Across the seas that cover more than 70% of the Earth's surface, plastics are increasingly polluting the world's oceans. Marine researchers say between 5 and 12 million metric tons of plastic finds its way into our oceans each year. The images that often come to mind are giant heaps of trash floating in the water. But Mark Dix, who heads one of the U.S. government's top science agencies, says that's not entirely accurate.
Now, it's actually not correct to be thinking of it as some sort of giant raft of debris or material, because that material that's out there is actually widely dispersed. You can find increased concentrations of debris out in that gyre, but it's a very large space.
Here in the U.S., conservation groups encourage volunteers to take part in trash cleanup efforts around local water outlets. But unlike other environmental issues, cleaning up the world's oceans is a cause that appears to be uniting lawmakers on both sides of the aisle, says Senator Dan Sullivan, co-sponsor of the proposed Save Our Seas Act.
What was really important about this bill, it wasn't just bipartisan, but as opposed to just saying, hey, we're going to get with the environmental groups to support this, we have many conservation groups that are being helping. We also went to industry and said, look, this is a big problem. You guys can be part of the solution.
Partnering with groups at the international, state, and local levels is crucial, says Julia Robertson with the Ocean Conservancy Group.
We are putting more in than we are taking out right now, and that is a problem. But the good news is that we can solve this problem. There is a role for industry, there's a role for governments, and there's a role for an individual consumer to tackle this problem.
Global prevention and helping developing countries better manage their waste must be a top priority, says plastics industry expert Steve Russell.
It's not to say that countries that are putting in just a little bit shouldn't aim to do better, but if we really want to impact the volumes going in so that we start putting in less and take out more, then we have to address those parts of the world that just don't have access yet to waste management.
A solution to this global crisis is achievable, say experts, but it begins with an individual commitment to recycle, reuse, and properly dispose of waste. Elizabeth Cherneff, VOA News, Washington.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Brunei Rugby will be competing in the Asia Rugby Sevens Trophy in Singapore from the 4th till the 5th of August. Brunei will be in Pool C along with Singapore, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Laos. Other national teams competing are Thailand, Iran, Nepal, and Indonesia. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, since May, the price per bushel of soybeans has dropped almost 20% in the wake of an escalating trade war between the United States and China. Tariffs threaten to cut off an important export market for U.S. farmers, while also cutting into profits for farmers already experiencing a fifth year of declining farm income. As VOA's Kane Faribault reports, despite plans for a massive aid package by the Trump administration, what producers most want is reliable access to the world's largest markets.
The rolling and robust fields of soybean growing on Fred Greeter's Illinois farm would be a welcome sign most years, indicating a promising harvest in the fall. But tariffs are turning away potential customers overseas, and Greeter estimates he could lose around $100 an acre if the trade war continues.
It's a squeeze.
A squeeze acknowledged by the Trump administration, prompting the U.S. Department of Agriculture to plan a $12 billion aid package to help farmers like Greeter.
If you take the $12 billion, which assuming it'll all go to beans, which it won't, and divide that by our planted acreage, that's about $14 an acre.
And you're looking at a $100 loss an acre.
That's correct.
So you're still out $86.
That's correct.
It's not that Greeter isn't grateful. He'd just rather have trade over aid.
The aid package certainly is appreciated, and we appreciate the fact that USDA and the president is concerned about us and wants to try to make us whole, but the reality is that the numbers in a large trade war like this are just overwhelming.
This is not a natural disaster. This is a man-made disaster. It's not an act of God, but some would call it an act of foolishness.
Mark Albertson is the Director of Strategic Market Development for the Illinois Soybean Association. He says the trade dispute with China is a greater threat to farmers than the drought of 2012.
But we had mechanisms in place to deal with that, and we always knew that the very next year we would be able to plant our crops again and hope for the best. In this case, we don't know that. We don't know what the next year brings. We don't have necessarily hope of the trade war going away very soon. And it looks like Brazil is all too eager to take away our market share when it comes to China.
Which is Farmer Greeter's biggest concern.
Brazil, one of our largest competitors, they're always expanding. So this could affect our market years down the road. And I'm probably more worried about that than I am just a short-term washout here.
The other challenge is what to do with the soybeans that can't be sold.
It looks like we may end up putting a record amount of soybeans in storage. And when that happens, we know from history that the prices will go south.
For now, Greeter's routine remains the same. He hopes strong global demand for soybeans outside China will make up for decreasing prices, and is waiting to see if President Donald Trump's trade tactics will work before permanent damage is done to the reputation and reliability of U.S. grain products.
I support what he's trying to do. I can't say that I support his methods.
Methods that could create greater uncertainty and smaller profits for U.S. farmers. Kane Fairbaugh, VOA News, Bloomington, Illinois.
Imagine this, a fully autonomous, 3D-printed mobile house that can survive any weather and is completely self-powered. Now, this is not a technological dream. It's the ambitious project of a Ukrainian company called PassiveDom. It's working on the prototype of a printed home in Reno, Nevada. VOA's Luya Larmolenka gives us a look inside the 3D-printed walls of this futuristic house.
This workshop in Reno, Nevada is where the first 3D-printed mobile and autonomous home in the U.S. is going to be made. This self-powered and transportable house is the idea of a Ukrainian startup called PassiveDom.
People are dreamers. They dream to live up in the mountains near a waterfall or the ocean. But building a house in the mountains means wiring it for electricity, having drinking water and a sewage system. This may cost more than the house itself.
PassiveDom founder Maxim Gorbud says the trickiest part was dealing with energy costs.
We managed to lower the heat loss by 20 to 40 times. Now heating this home at negative 20 Celsius will equal about 800 watt an hour, less than what needed to boil a cup of coffee.
Thick windows filled with inert gas are almost impossible to break and help keep the house warm, an important feature because two out of four walls are made of glass. Solar panels provide electricity and charge batteries for nighttime power. But the most interesting part is the walls themselves, 3D printed and made of carbon fiber and fiberglass.
They're extremely durable. You can't even compare the material to brick or wood. It's hundreds of times more lasting.
Anton Getman says the smart mobile has nearly 200 sensors. More than 15 microcomputers handle the water supply, air filtering, and power system control. The computers allow the house to self-regulate depending on weather conditions. Moreover, the house keeps an eye on itself and the welfare of its inhabitants.
We have developed infrared sensors that monitor and analyze people's movements. If a person, say, lay on the bed and doesn't get up for a long time, or his body temperature goes up and down, we see these changes and can suggest calling an ambulance or tell relatives to get in touch with the person.
The home can also be equipped with an atmospheric water generator that could condense water from the air and a water purification system for water already used.
The house can store drinking water and energy that will last for months, if need be. So even if something happens, some catastrophe or something like that, you can be safe inside this home.
The small home is 38 square meters and will cost between $64,000 and $97,000. PassiveDom hopes to present its first home at the end of August and start mass production in early 2019. For Yulia Yermolenko in Reno, Nevada, I'm Anna Rice, VOA News.
Ending out this week, this final note. Chinese police broke into the home of a retired Shandong University professor who is critical of China's human rights record as he was expressing via a telephone interview his opinions on VOA's Mandarin TV show Issues and Opinions. VOA Mandarin has attempted to reach Professor Wen Guangsun by cell phone. Since he was removed from his home during the night broadcast, the professor who lives in Xinjiang has not responded. Quote, I'm entitled to express my opinion. This is my freedom of speech, were the professor's last words heard on the show. Well, that's our program for this week. Thank you so much for being with us. We hope you have a great weekend, and we'll see you again on Monday.